It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
And let's do that, and let's welcome the stars of our show today, Cecil Harvell on the phone with us. Good morning, Cecil. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Wonderful, wonderful. And in studio with us here is Wes Collins. So, gentlemen, I will defer to you. What are we talking about today?
I think, Mike, we've been talking, as you know, Mike, about the duties of an executor, the responsibilities that they take on, how we at our law firm help guide them through these responsibilities. Every now and then, though, of course, Mike, an executor will get off track, not be able to perform the duties as required by the North Carolina statute. And we then are forced to petition the court for the revocation of the letters or the granting of the authority to serve as executor. And revocation, of course, means for the court to make a change, to appoint a new executor. And so Wes and I this morning want to talk about some of the circumstances that lead to that kind of filing. We do handle quite a few of those. And let me just get out of the gate here one more sentence or two, Mike, which is that, the court does not want to revoke the letters of the letters testamentary, the authority of the executor. After all, as we've discussed, the executor is the person, the individual that has been appointed in the very document to serve on behalf of the decedent. And so, obviously, the court wants to allow that person to serve. They want to help that person along as best as they can. And I want Wes to talk more about this, but usually the purposes by which executorships are revoked is there's almost, just a gross amount of negligence. Because again, it's a high bar for us to come in and petition the court to remove an executor and to prevail.
Yeah, I would imagine. So I'll send this over to Wes here as far as some of the reasons why someone would be revoked or removed as being an executor. I can almost think sometimes the natural causes or diminished mental capacity or not understanding all the heavy lifting that's involved in being an executor. Am I hitting some of the spots there that might cause someone to be revoked or removed as executor,
Wes? Yeah, I mean, sometimes, Mike, it's as it relates to some type of condition, like that. But normally the ones that end up in court, before the clerk, at a hearing, are things where the executor has grossly misstepped in their duties, meaning they have maybe helped themselves to some money that they should not have, meaning that they have failed to account properly to the court and to the beneficiaries of the estate as required by law. Understand that the court's position in the administration of an estate is incredibly important, but they don't do the administration. They don't handle the money, the court. They don't file the accountings. They make sure that the administrator or the executor, also known as the personal representative, carries out their job consistent with the North Carolina general statutes relating to those issues. And you understand, this is putting, in many cases, an executor in a position that they've never been in before. Folks handle their personal financial situations, and they handle their own money, and they pay their bills, and they deal with these things most people walking up down the street do that. But most people don't end up in a situation where all of a sudden they're put in a spot where they're handling someone else's money. They're having to follow sometimes be a complicated maze of statutes in order to do it correctly. And sometimes when you have that dynamic, you have some missteps. But I would agree with Cecil. you know, when you're on the side of filing the petition to revoke letters, you don't just file it, you know, the first time you see a problem. What you do is you always reach out to whoever the administrator, executor, or personal representative is and give them an opportunity. You identify the issue, and you give them an opportunity to correct whatever that issue is. In the event they made a wrongful, a wrong or incorrect distribution, ask them to return it. In the event that they haven't filed an accounting as required by law and that needs to be done, ask them to do that or ask the clerk to get them to do that. In the event that they are not acting as the statute state expeditiously, meaning quickly, then send them a letter to prod them along a little bit. You're supposed to wrap this up. In the event they haven't dealt with a debt of the estate appropriately, or they're not dealing with an asset of the estate appropriately, for example, sometimes you have situations where there's real estate, and in many cases, and maybe it's rental real estate, and that creates lots of confusion sometimes. What do you do with the rental money? You know, whose is it legally? We have debts in this estate, you know. We have mortgages. Do the mortgages go with the property? There's a lot of moving parts where good legal counsel is going to keep the executor in a position where, you know, they're going to stay on the right side of the line.
Right.
In the event they don't have good legal counsel, then they might step over that line and create some problems for themselves.
I can see now that you've unpacked that, Wes and Cecil, check me if I'm wrong here, but, it sounds like when the executor is flying blindly, just on their own out there without legal counsel from Harvell and Collins or from a, you know, reputable, law firm, to help them guide them through this process, which can be, challenging. The temptation too to take that money and maybe buy yourself a new truck this year versus you know being fiduciarily responsible in paying off you know liquidating the assets in a proper way with the debt in a proper area. It sounds to me like if you had Wes or Cecil by your side during this process, it's a lot easier and clean.
Mike, I think what I see so many times and what we see at the office is it begins with kind of just a lack of appreciation on behalf of the executor. The importance of the deadlines, the importance of the accuracy of their accountings. I have a file on my desk right now. A sister has called in and her brother is the executor, and he's been the executor now for 2 years. And she and her other sister just are unable to get their brother to, you know, to move and to finalize and to conclude, this estate and bring it to closure. And when you ask her, well, what do you think, are the issues with your brother? Well, you know, he just doesn't think it's that important. It's not a priority to him.
Mm-hmm.
He just recently moved from North Carolina to Florida. He has had some, you know, some personal issues, whatever they might be. You know, life, as we know, Mike, touches and concerns all of us, including each and every one of our clients who, or cases where there happens to be an executor involved. So maybe this brother has, you know, gone through a divorce or maybe has other life issues that are happening. Well, you know, there can be some sympathetic and work with factor, as Wes was just mentioning, by writing a letter, by working along with such a person to maybe bring the file to closure. But sometimes these folks won't respond.
Mm-hmm.
Their filings are with the court are terribly late. When they do file them, they're not complete. They're not accurate. They just simply are putting something out there on record to meet a deadline, but the substantive work that's in the accounting is not accurate. These are the kinds of things that begin to very much kindle the fire for a petition before the court to revoke the letters of administration or letters testamentary, taking away the authority of the executor.
When you looked at that file, Cecil, you mentioned that it was taking 2 years. Does that seem unusually long? 2 years for the type of case it was,
and does the type of case that it was? Absolutely,
Does the court? Does the court put out a timetable on what it should take to conclude everything?
Yeah, it does, Mike. The clerk of court in all of our jurisdictions, you know, here, Wes is on his way to Wilmington this morning. We're in New Hanover, we're in Craven, we're in Onslow, Carteret, Jones, Pamlico counties. We know all of the clerks in all of those counties, and they're wonderful. And they will send out a notice to the personal representative letting them know that their accounting is due and giving them, you know, a 30-day period to file it. They will then send out another notice, and at this point they will say that they are going to send out the sheriff, the deputy sheriff in that particular county, to give them notice of the fact that they need to appear before the clerk, order to appear before the clerk as to why you have not filed the accounting. Well, so the clerks of court are helping, absolutely, we lawyers. But, you know, Ben, we have people like this gentleman in Florida that doesn't even respond to those things.
Yeah.
You know, that is non-responsive for whatever the reason is.
Let's take our first break here, gentlemen. If you'd like to learn more, call Harvell and Collins today, 252-726-9050. Or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll take a short break here and return. We're talking about the revocation of the executor. It's a high bar to cross, but nonetheless, it can happen. And we're learning details about how that occurs with Harvell and Collins. Let's Talk Legal. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about the revocation of an executor, and it's a high bar. That's not just something that the court takes if you say, well, they're not doing it fast enough. You're going to have a lot of criteria, a lot of reasons why the person should be removed. I asked Wes during the break, Cecil, if someone was an executor and they were really doing a terrible job and they were taking a lot of money that wasn't theirs properly, can it ever swerve into a criminal charge?
Yes, it can. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, given the
good deal.
You know, that criminal intent, I mean, you know, that it would have to be more than just negligence or carelessness, but you know, if anyone criminally intends to take funds, then that's certainly that could be referred to a district attorney, and a district attorney would take a long and hard look at it. This is where a little of a side note, but I think our listeners will enjoy hearing it. This is why in an estate where there is no will that waives a bond, in an estate where the estate is opened up under administration, North Carolina requires that the executor, personal representative, administrator post a bond. And a bond is a contract with an insurance company that assures the beneficiaries that should the personal representative, as you were mentioning, Mike, steal from the estate, then the beneficiaries have a insurance policy that will reimburse them for that theft. Now, in a last will and testament that is prepared by a lawyer, such as you know, our office or any other good law firm, the lawyer is going to, in the document, waive the bond for the executor. And the reason for that, Mike, of course, is that the client is appointing who they trust.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the client is appointing their son or their daughter or, you know, their wife or husband, whoever the case might be, someone in the family many times, and it's someone that they have confidence in. That's why they're telling Wes and myself to put them in the document. So we put them in the document and we waive the bond in those estates. But in an estate that doesn't have a last will and testament, the bond cannot be waived, and North Carolina law is going to require it.
You know, now that you mentioned about having to get an insurance bond as an executor, perhaps, it's just all the more reason to saddle up with Harvell and Collins from the get-go so that you can guide me and help me and do some of that stuff that I would have to do on my own. And I think people, Wes and Cecil, they have this misconception that it's just an extraordinary amount of money to hire an attorney to help them through this process, when in fact the hassles and the mistakes you could possibly make far outweigh the cost of hiring counsel.
No doubt about that, Mike. I mean, you know, as we talk about on the program all the time, you know, putting a plan in place is always much cheaper, much less expensive than dealing with the fallout in the event that there was a failure to plan. I mean, that's almost 100% of the time. Sure. in what we do. I do want to go back momentarily to the issue that you brought up with regard to criminal liability and tell you about a particular case that I dealt with years ago. I think we have a little bit of time. There's a case involving a grandson who contacted me from another state indicating that he was going through his deceased mother's things and found evidence of a check that had been sent to her that had never been negotiated. It had never been deposited, so presented. On and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it was a check from the deceased grandmother's estate, who was a Carteret County resident. So he inquired about, you know, whether she actually received those funds because they would have passed down to him, and mm-hmm. he doesn't think that she did, and my mom wasn't doing well at that point in time. She probably wouldn't have followed up with it because she was having some health problems herself, and, you know, my uncle was the executor along with my aunt. You know, Mr. Collins, can you peel back the layers of the onion here and see if we can see what happened? You know, so we do. And this was an estate that was about 8 or 9 years old, and it had been closed many years ago. But what we found is we found that the co-executors, the aunt, the uncle, apparently tried to make the distribution, which was six figures. It was, wow, a significant amount to this, mm-hmm, mother. Apparently she didn't accept it, or she didn't, because of her own personal situation, she didn't take it to the bank, whatever, didn't negotiate it. So the uncle... the aunt and the uncle basically decided, well, if she's not going to take it, we're just going to distribute it to ourselves.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough.
We got to close out the account, so yeah, that's what we're going to do.
Final call. Last call.
So in the 8 years that had passed, the uncle had died. And the only person who was living, you know, in this scenario, of course, I've got the grandson who's, mm-hmm, calling me,
yeah,
but he really wasn't in the scenario at that point in time, but is the aunt, and she was a co-executor. So she kind of, you know, I think that what happened is most of that money, if not all of that money that should have gone to the right person, should have gone to the mother here, went to the uncle.
Okay. Yeah.
So the person who's living didn't really get any benefit from this money being taken.
The dead uncle got it.
Well, guess what? She's personally liable for it. She let it happen. It happened, and it didn't get distributed correctly. So she had to write a check out of her own personal money to make that right.
For the proper amount.
And she, mm-hmm, may have had a claim against that uncle's estate to try to get that money back. But my understanding is he didn't have much of anything. Okay, so that is a, you know, kind of a story of how that personal liability can extend. It's been several years now, but I think that she signed the check that ended up going to the uncle with the understanding that he was going to hold that money and eventually get it to his sister, his, yeah, other sister,
mm-hmm,
but never did. So I guess they thought the time would go by and no one would do anything about it and so on and so forth. And he helped himself eventually out to six figures of money and had to deal with it, plus interest. And so that got unwound, and it was interesting. You know, you don't look back at those statute of limitations that often, but I did find when I was doing that there were two statute of limitations, which is how long you would have to bring a suit.
Yeah.
The 10-year statute of limitations, so we were barely in that on constructive fraud, which is a statute of limitations that we use in a lot of cases that we deal with, fiduciary litigation cases. But also there's some law in North Carolina indicating that if you impeach an accounting, then there's no statute of limitations. And what that basically means is that if the accounting that was submitted to the clerk of court is inaccurate, is false, incorrect information, then you can come back any point in time, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later.
Wow. There's no deadline.
And attack that. And that's exactly what had happened here.
Yeah.
We were within the 10 years, but we would have been able to impeach the accounting because what was represented to the court was not what actually happened. Now, I will mention one more thing about this. This was pre-change in North Carolina. About 4 or 5 years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, everything tightened up in estate administration.
Mm-hmm.
It got more difficult. There's higher accounting requirements. You have to file bank statements with your accountings to show how the money's actually been dispersed. You have to show images of checks. You didn't have to do that. This is exactly why.
Yeah.
He reported, these people, these co-executors reported that one thing happened, proper distribution, payment.
And it didn't.
And that's not what happened.
Wow.
There was no third-party documentation to show one way or another.
Interesting.
You can't do that anymore. And this is a perfect example why the state doesn't allow that anymore.
Very interesting. Gentlemen, let's take our final break here so we have a little bit of time to close on today's conversation. We're talking with our friends from Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. If you'd like to have a conversation with them, call them, 252-726-9050. Go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll take a short break here and return after this. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And, gentlemen, we have about 2 minutes to go. I'll defer to either Wes or Cecil.
So,
Mike, I'd like to go back just a minute to a statement you made about the cost, because, you know, that's a legitimate thing to discuss. And Wes and I aren't the least bit fearful of discussing cost with a client. And let's begin with this statement that so many folks believe that the attorney firm, that the law firm, is going to charge a percentage of the estate. And so, you know, gosh, if I go talk to this lawyer, the law firm is going to take 5% or 10%. I mean, people just imagine these very high percentages, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just not, that's not real. That's a misunderstanding, okay? We are 9 times out of 10 assisting the executor of an estate or personal representative on an hourly rate, And we're able to account to this executor and or personal representative or the family member, if it's a family member that's involved in an estate, we're able to show them what our hours are that have been expended in the file. Sometimes, Mike, this is just a matter of, you know, a few hours, 5, 10, 15, 20 hours of time, so as to just get the matter back on track.
Yep.
Like this file that I mentioned with this lady that lives here, but her executor brother has now moved to Florida.
Yep.
That may be something that will just take, you know, a dozen hours or so to get that matter back on track.
It's a good point. Wes, thank you.
Yep. I can see the clock. I'm here. 5, 4, 3,
shot clock.
2, 1. Cecil can't see that.